come on, Lyle, let's rock and roll.
We'll call this meeting to order of the House Ag and Rural Development Committee, March 8th, 2:30 p.m. We do not have a quorum, but as you know, folks, the Ag Committee does start on time. And we're very fortunate today to have three bills that we're going to be hearing. The first, as is tradition for the eighth year running, we have this is the least partisan committee in the House. We start out with the DFL bill. Representative Peterson, if you could please come forward. I will move House File 2645 when we actually have a quorum, but we'd like to get started on your bill. The agenda members today, as you can see, is a Peterson bill, a David's bill, and then a report from the Minnesota Board of Animal Health regarding bovine tuberculosis. It's a very serious issue that we want to stay on top of, and we'll basically have an update in the rest of the committee time after the first two bills will be given to Dr. Hartman and others. That being said, if Representative Peterson could come to the table. I saw Representative Peterson here. If someone could try and find the chief author of the first bill, that would be a good thing. Is there anyone here to testify to the Peterson bill? We have on our list a Sue Persick, Swift County, Belinda Sanders, Rob Wolfington.
Last time I suggest anything the first book.
Then we'd have her. Would you like to take over the Peterson bill? If the page could go out and put an APB on our Representative Peterson and see if we can get him in. Just
yeah, I saw
members, we will wait for Representative Peterson and we will wait for members. So, yeah.
Is it like all pumping water on the farm?
I guess so. Welcome to Committee Representative Peterson. When we have a quorum here, we're going to go ahead with the bills.
Okay.
When we have a quorum, I'll officially call a meeting to order and I'll officially move your bill. But Representative Peterson has House File 2645. If you could please describe the bill to the committee, please, Representative Peterson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and my testifiers, I've been running around looking for them, so apologize for being a little late. This is basically expanding the membership of the RFA board in Swift County, and it would be subject to local approval. And without my testifiers to justify exactly why, my testimony is very, very brief.
Well, thank you, Representative Peterson. I'm sure there's a good reason why. We don't have a quorum yet either. I'd like to act on this bill. Let me ask this question. Is there anyone that wishes to testify against this bill in the audience? Is there anyone that wishes to testify for the bill? Okay. Are there any questions? Thank you. I need some help there. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, it's increasing the size of the board, Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson. And is this Was this board undersized as compared to others before this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I represent Pennis. As compared to other counties, I have not done that analysis. So
oh.
No.
Representative Pennis? Okay. What we'll do, I think, is since there are no other questions here, we will lay this one over. We will be voting on this one first. We always vote on the DFL bills first. We will vote on this one first, but in the meantime, since there's no one here to testify right now, Representative Peterson, when this passes out of here, where do you need it to go to? To the floor? Does this go right to the floor?
I think that would be my preferred method.
Okay, so my motion will be to move this bill directly to the floor.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we'll go to the next bill.
If I may, can I go find my testifiers? And
go find them, bring them back, and what we'll do is, before we act on any other bills, we'll act on yours first.
Thank you.
So.
You're
going to
hurt his chances.
Well, yeah.
I know.
I think things are looking good right now for you. Okay, with that, we'll go to a David's bill, House File 2781. When we have a quorum, I'll move my bill. Mr. Dick Hemmingson, University of Minnesota, if you could please come to the table to describe what we're trying to do here. And I'll be very clear for the record. Mr. Hemmingson met with me some weeks ago, never asked me to put a bill in, but was just going through some different ideas that he had. And need some technical help here.
Well, I'm going to have to unhook this to get out of mine. So I hope.
Okay.
All right. Nope.
Just don't delete anything.
We need one more.
Yep.
One more.
We'll let you get set up here.
All right. Well, let's see what we can do here. I'll be needing some technical help on getting it onto the screen. Let's try this here.
I'm alive at my age.
Try to reboot it.
Yeah.
I apologize, Mr. Chair.
We'll officially call the meeting to order. We do have a legislative assistant who will note the roll. And at this time, I'd like to make an introduction to the committee. The staff here, we have a committee administrator. Mark Nicely is the new Ag and Rural Development Committee Administrator. And Chris Wolford is the new committee legislative assistant. Chris worked with me for 10 years, and she still came back, so that's pretty amazing. It's wonderful to have Chris back here. A couple announcements here. First of all, were there some minutes that we need to approve, or is that not from last year? Nothing. No minutes. Okay. Okay. I'd like to make an announcement. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture committee members and staff are invited to a legislative open house reception and tour on Monday, March 13th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. So everyone is encouraged to attend, and there are appetizers and beverages. So that is a good thing. Okay, what we'll do now is we'll go into Mr. Hemmingson's presentation, and then when that's done, we will go back to Representative Peterson's bill, and we'll pass it whether he likes it or not. We're going to move on that, but we're going to wait a little bit so that he can see if some of the folks that came from Swift County can come in and testify as to what they want to do here. Okay, Mr. Hemmingson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dick Hemmingson with the University of Minnesota's Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment. And I have to say, at least so far today, it's nice to be back in front of you after a year or two's hiatus from representing the university in government relations. And I'm pleased to speak to you today about our aspirations at the university to establish the National Center for Biofuels Research at the University of Minnesota as part of the natural progression of this initiative for renewable energy in the environment. I need to point out to the committee that this facility, while it is placed in the university's six-year capital improvement program, it is in a category for seeking federal funding, and as such is not in the university's prioritized list for seeking state funding. I'm going to take just a few minutes and will apologize for the first few slides, which you will probably see again next week in terms of the overall IREE overview, but I thought it important to set the opportunities for this facility in some context. And so just, if you'll permit me, a few slides. This is one that I think we're all probably familiar with. Looks at U.S. energy consumption over the last 150 years. And one of the things I find most striking about this is if you look way in the lower left-hand side of the graph, you will see that in the 1850s or so, we were essentially a renewable-based economy with respect to our energy needs. And we've progressed over the years to a variety of petroleum or fossil fuel-based sources. And as we fast forward to where we are today, way up there in the upper right-hand portion of this slide, you see a thin sliver again of renewables that we are using for our energy procurement.
Mr. Hemmingson, excuse me for just a second. I will move House File 2781 be recommended, passed, and sent to the Capital Investment Committee. Please proceed.
This is a slide which shows another view of our dependence with respect to transportation fuels and our dependence on foreign oil. And essentially this graph, as you can see, shows where those oil reserves are and who is using them. And a couple of compelling points for me as I look at this slide is beyond where the oil reserves are located, the U.S. uses about 26% of the world's oil supply. Or looked at another way, the U.S. uses more than the next five highest consuming nations of transportation fuel. So that's another sort of piece of context. Another piece of context is this initiative for renewable energy and environment at the University of Minnesota, which was funded by the 2003 legislature. And what, by brief way of summary, those funds made available to this initiative included $10 million in funding from Xcel Energy's Renewable Development Fund at that time, and an additional portion of Xcel Energy's Annual Conservation Improvement Program, or CIP, obligation. These funds amounted to roughly a $20 million research portfolio with which this initiative has invested in a variety of research projects, which I'll be summarizing more completely at the committee next week. I wanted to point out two of the elements of the authorizing language in that those funds that were made available, and those are, you see on the screen here, the development of environmentally sound production, distribution, and use of energy chemicals and materials from renewable sources, and processing and utilizing agricultural and forestry plant products and other bio-based sources as a substitute for fossil fuels. So my point here is that is part of the charge, if you will, the legislature provided us that we have taken very seriously in this initiative, and you see some of the other components which we can talk in some more detail about next week. To fast forward a bit then to the opportunity before us today with respect to this National Center, this is what IREE's investment portfolio looks like, if you will, in terms of how we have deployed these resources. A significant emphasis on biofuels and bioproducts, a significant emphasis on hydrogen, a significant emphasis on efficient renewable energy systems, which includes our work in wind and solar research, and some significant emphasis in issues surrounding policy, economics, ecosystems, and carbon sequestration. My point of this slide is this business of transforming our state's biomass materials into fuels and products is a significant focus for this initiative at the University of Minnesota. Another piece of background or context I bring before you today is actually five-year-old data now from a study done in 2001, which talked about the market opportunities for biotechnology. Again, this is five-year-old data now, but it makes, I think, an important point. And this study looked at what the current economic impact of biotechnology was, for example, in the health sector, and what they projected back in 2001 might be the economic market potential for biotechnology that relates to healthcare. What's significant, I think, to this issue is that same study also looked at the market potential of biotechnology for the agricultural sector and the industrial sector. And you can read the numbers there as well as I can in terms of the estimates that were made, again, 5 or 6 years ago about the market potential for biotechnology markets as it relates to the agricultural and industrial sector. And the biosciences then arguably are very important, critically important, one might argue, for the success not only in the healthcare arena, but also in the agricultural and industrial sector. As a part of those biosciences then, as one final sort of piece of context, I want to talk about a sort of subset of that science of biosciences, biocatalysis. And typically what we have talked about, and importantly so, is that translational research using this fundamental science of biocatalysis, which before someone asks me for a definition, I'm going to show one on the screen and give you Dick's definition. It's having bugs do your work for you. And I'll explain that hopefully a bit better later on. But in the medical field, certainly this translational research leads to drug precursors and nutraceuticals. But what we also have the opportunity to look at significantly, and what we are doing in this initiative, is translational research on the agro-industrial side. And utilizing these biocatalytic reactions, biological reactions, for things like bioremediation. For example, through the science of biocatalysis, and enzymes have been developed, biological enzymes, which can, for example, clean up atrazine spills in soil. So that's an example of bioremediation. The growing and burgeoning green chemical industry is a output of this biocatalysis, and also the potential that is real and before us and looming before us in terms of potential, in terms of fuels and biofuels and bioproducts. And those two areas, along with a significant emphasis on renewable hydrogen, which this committee had an overview of about a year and a half, or a year or so ago, as I recall, like Dr. Lenny Schmidt, wind, solar, and efficient utilization, and these issues of policy, economics, and ecosystems, then are the essence of this initiative in renewable energy and environment. And this proposed National Center for Biofuels Research is really in the sweet spot of those activities, looking at fuels and products from a variety of renewable sources. And so this underlying science of biocatalysis, while critically important to the healthcare industry, is essential to the further development of next-generation fuels and products from bio resources. So a quick bit of history. I apologize for the fuzziness of this slide. It's a PDF file. Actually, as you can see, a slide borrowed from Cargill. But, you know, ethanol was not new. It was developed back in the 1860s, essentially as a lamp oil. There were further developments about the time that an oil well was drilled in Pennsylvania. The Union Congress actually passed a tax, interestingly, a tax on ethanol to help fund the Civil War, although the tax on the ethanol was significantly less at the time. Then a guy by the name of Rockefeller, bought a small refinery and decided to call it Standard Oil. Ethanol was used proposed as the fuel for the first Model T. But then, looking back to that very first chart, the so-called petroleum revolution hit, and with a spurt of activity in the 70s in the context of the energy crisis, in some sense we're sort of back to the future again with respect to the potential for fuels, energy, and products from renewable sources. So ethanol, as you are all aware, as we know it today, is a pretty straightforward practice, taking the grain from corn primarily, at least in this part of the country, hydrolyzing the starch with enzymes, again, by the way, a biocatalytic process, fermenting those simple sugars, glucose, to product recovery, which is ethanol, distillers, dried grains, and in some cases, food products. And so this is essentially the existing ethanol process as we know it today. One of the many opportunities that are being explored here and across the country is more of a cellulosic ethanol production, and there are a lot of sugars which can be converted into ethanol in the lignin, the woody fibrous material of the plants, and thank goodness it's there, or our corn stalks wouldn't stand up, or even more of our small grains would lodge every year, and so forth. But the sugars that are contained in that cellulose are tough things to get out. We've obviously taken the low-hanging fruit in the context of corn grain ethanol. And this is where we look at the sort of the next generation, the so-called integrated biorefinery of not only potentially
taking the grain and hydrolyzing the starch, but pre-treating that lignin, those woody or fibrous plant materials, to hydrolyze that cellulose and drive out an even more robust and substantially higher yielding set of sugars that would then be fermented to an increasing array of products, ethanol, DDGs, food products, and a whole host of other chemicals. And the resulting leftovers could be through thermochemical reverse conversion, or in fact the lignocellulosic material itself, corn stover, let's say, or whatever, actually converted through a thermochemical conversion at the process for at the processing plant for combined heat and power. So this so-called next generation biorefineries is one example of the things we're working on and that would be done in this proposed National Center for Biofuels research. And just to come back to this science of biocatalysis, it's at work really on both ends of this process in the so-called integrated biorefinery, on the front end in terms of breaking down the lignin, and on the back end in terms of reforming these products. So looking at this issue of biorefineries of the future, the goal is to take a wide array of biomass feedstocks, parenthetically, all of which we have here in Minnesota. I made, I think, the mistake at one point a year and a half ago of visiting with a reporter and talking about the opportunity for converting biomass and the rich resources that we enjoy in this state in terms of a wide array of biomass. And I said, apparently, because she put it in the article, we grow a lot of stuff here. Well, the fact of the matter is we do grow a lot of stuff here. Much of that can be converted through a variety of conversion processes that you see kind of in the middle of this slide to a variety of products that for the most part currently are derived from fossil fuel-based sources. So that, in a nutshell, is a significant part of the research that's underway at the university and that would continue in this proposed National Center for Biofuels research. So the opportunities here are significant, and the current debate revolves not only around energy, of course, and increasingly around national energy security, economics, the environment, and of course the opportunities that are before us now in this state to significantly move forward in this regard, which leads us then to what is this proposed national center. Well, establishing this National Center of Biofuels Research at the University of Minnesota, we think builds on the position of the state as a leader in biofuels technology and policies, for that matter. The academic and comprehensive academic strengths, I might add, of the University of Minnesota and the success of this initiative that you and your colleagues helped make possible back in the 2003 session. And this proposed facility will house what we feel will be the premier biofuels research, technology, teaching, and technology development and transfer program in the nation. The master planning that occurred at the University of Minnesota on the Twin Cities campus some years ago has identified a site. For those of you familiar with the St. Paul campus, it would be immediately south of the Cargill building for microbial and plant genomics, so that would be the proposed site. And why do we think we need to do this in Minnesota? Well, I've touched on some of those points. We clearly, as I mentioned, are a national leader in the development and commercialization of new and innovative technologies across the board, not just in this arena. We are a national leader in the production and use of renewable fuels. We are a national leader in renewable energy policy incentives of various kinds. We have, I think, the demonstrated capacity to develop new and innovative business models, and they abound all around us. And we have a vibrant and innovative business community. We have, as I said earlier, the capacity to grow a lot of stuff here in a wide range of biomass materials that do grow well or can grow well in Minnesota, and some of the samples that you're very familiar with are depicted here in this photograph. Why would we want to do this at the University of Minnesota? Well, we have a marvelous university. Of course, I'm a bit biased in that regard, especially when I look at the bottom of my paycheck every 2 weeks, but the fact is we do have a world-class, comprehensive public and land-grant research university here in our midst. And all more or less under one roof have the kind of academic expertise we need to work in these multidimensional areas, the Institute of Technology, the Agricultural Sciences, Biological Sciences, Natural Resource Sciences, Economics, Policy, Business Law, all under one roof, albeit sometimes a pretty expansive roof. But the fact is we're all here under one institution, and this initiative has worked really hard, as we'll hear more about next week, in bringing these diverse academic strengths together. We have a very competitive and world-class faculty that competes well. Just by way of example, over the last few years, we've done very well in competitive grant arenas for federal funds across the board. We've done fairly well in Department of Energy grants. Just recently, the University of Minnesota Morris and the West Central Research Outreach Center, for example, garnered a $1.8 million biomass grant award, and we're working to develop strong partnerships with the National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Argonne, and other places. And we will be and are developing the next generation of students that will be the workforce for this emerging industry. Who are some of these world-class faculty? Well, you see some of them here. Larry Wackett, who is working on these biocatalytic reactions to create long-chain carbon sugars in real time using biocatalysis rather than 500 million-year-old photosynthesis that we're extracting out of the ground. Roger Ruan in the center, the head of our Center of Biorefining. Romas Kozlowskis working on the real fundamental science of sugar partitioning in plants, and a student on the left in our Center for Diesel Research. And finally on this slide, we have, I believe, six active Regents professors amongst the 3,500 or so faculty at the university. Two of them are pictured on this slide and are heavily engaged in this initiative at the university. David Tillman on top, the world's leading ecologist, and individual who is familiar to this committee, Lanny Schmidt, who is working on this autothermal reforming and, in his case, extracting hydrogen from ethanol. We have this initiative at the University of Minnesota that is made significant investments in this arena that we have, that has, we think, advanced Minnesota and the university stature in this regard. We currently have over 200 faculty across this university engaged in these projects. About two-thirds of our portfolio, as I showed earlier, relates to bioenergy and bioproducts, and the largest biosciences incubator in the Midwest in university enterprise labs, and a really new thrust within the Office of Business Development in terms of commercializing these technologies. The last couple slides then speak to what would be housed in this facility. Well, as we have engaged in the program planning now, the Center for Biorefining, the IREE has already invested in some pilot-scale equipment for what we're currently calling the Biofuels and Products Innovation Laboratory. This is essentially pilot-scale equipment where faculty at the university, businesses, and industries can come to test processes, to quantify processes, and so forth. Our Center for Diesel Research has had a long-standing involvement in, for example, the biodiesel development industry, but they are expanding with the help of IRE into more of a biofuels utilization laboratory. The BTI, the Biotechnology Institute, would be expanded with a whole array of equipment and various platforms of fermenters and so forth that would be available not only to the university community but to businesses and industries. The Jubilee Renewable Energy Chair, I want to mention, the Norwegian government last fall when the Prince was here came with a check for $750,000 to invest in a renewable energy chair that will be joint, an endowed chair, matched with permanent university funds that will rotate between Norway and the U.S. working on these issues of renewable energy. We would envision a number of different kinds of faculty, both resident research and outreach faculty, visiting scholars, adjunct faculty, perhaps national laboratory scientists, in a model not unlike the ARS, Ag Research Service scientists that are currently housed on the St. Paul campus. And it would certainly have the potential, should it make sense, for certain state agency staff, federal agency staff, or staff from certain NGOs, should there be space and they want to be housed there. So it would be a facility that would house laboratory space not only for fundamental research, but more pilot scale facilities for businesses, industries, and faculty to begin to scale up these inventions. And finally, how this will impact Minnesota? Well, clearly our goal is to reduce the dependence of Minnesota on imported non-renewable fossil fuels, to develop the next generation and the next generation after that series of alternative fuels and integrated biorefinery systems. One of our core goals within the Initiative for Renewable Energy and Environment are the economic and job development opportunities. And for those of you who know where I come from, southwestern Minnesota, pardon the pun, but one of the things that gives me such energy in working with this initiative are the prospects it has for rural and agricultural economic development. And we will certainly improve the health and sustainability of our ecosystems and position Minnesota as a leader in renewable energy. And finally, if I may, just a few concluding thoughts, Mr. Chair. This is all around us. On the left is an article that you obviously can't read, but it's the lead editorial in the last issue of the Science magazine, and you can see the title, the Science magazine, Getting Serious About Biofuels. Some quotes from Governor Tim Pawlenty in terms of his endorsement of this concept at our annual research symposium in November, and a few comments from President Bush in his State of the Union address in terms of weaning ourselves from this dependence on foreign oil. And this is not the only place where this is happening. This is a slide of corn and soybean harvest in Brazil, and just a few quick factoids about ethanol production in Brazil, about mostly made from sugar, about 17 billion liters a year of ethanol production, estimated exports about 2 billion of that. They've been using hydrous ethanol in their automobiles since 1975, about 2.2 million vehicles, and their anhydrous ethanol blended at 25% by mandate, and that began in 1975. This past fall, at the invitation of the Commissioner of Agriculture and the Governor, we were pleased, Irie was, to participate in and actually co-host the World Biofuels Symposium in Beijing, China, as part of the Governor's trade mission to China. And I was struck with a lot of things that I saw there, this being my first opportunity to travel. But as I think about the opportunities we have in this country and this state, and I look at how some of the people in China live, as depicted in these slides, and how the rest of the people in China live, as depicted by those photographs, the question occurs to me, what are we going to do as a global society when the people in these photos, or the people in the previous photo, decide they want to live like the people in the photo you have before you in terms of their energy consumption? And China is doing something about it. We had the opportunity to visit the Jilin Fuel Alcohol Company. Well, it's just another ethanol plant, except it's the largest plant in the world. It is currently producing about 100 million gallons a year with capacity to go to 200 million gallons a year. That one plant is roughly half the current production of Minnesota's ethanol industry. So there is the case of a developing country really moving out on these opportunities for renewable fuels. So I sort of leave you with this slide that you can speculate as to whether or not this is the dawn of a new era with respect to renewable fuel and alternative fuel development, or in fact the sunset of our civilization as we know it. And I think the choice is ours and the opportunity is ours to really make Minnesota the epicenter of alternative and renewable fuels research. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude my comments. We'll be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Mr. Hemmingson. And now that we have more committee members here, I'd like to preface this with, I had a meeting some weeks ago with Mr. Hemmingson over several issues, and when he ran the one about the National Center for Biofuels by me, I took it and I said, let's go with it. And so it's not in the university's request. It has been endorsed in the past by Governor Pawlenty, and so I said, why wait on this one? Let's move. Just because it's not in the request doesn't mean we can't do it, because we're the Ag Committee and we can do whatever we want. So with that being said, we've got some questions. Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and with those words, we can do whatever we want. I like the proposal and everything. I think when I look at it, research, I've always thought research should be where the resources are. And when I look at the University of Minnesota Morris campus over there, what a great place for this building. If they're talking $2.5 million right now, $30 million down the road, we want to talk about rural infrastructure. We want to talk about really helping rural Minnesota. Here's the golden opportunity for us as an Ag Committee to finally vote for rural Minnesota instead of inner city. And I think we need to look at that. This would be just a great, great step up for whether it be Crookston, Morris, or whatever. But I think it should be in greater Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Heidgerken. And I think when Mr. Hemmingson said south of the Cargill building, he didn't mean quite that far south.
But I realize that, but probably as an Ag Committee, sorry, Mr. Chair, I think that we could lead the battle and say, hey, we've seen enough Cargill plants, we've seen enough slaughter plants, we've seen enough, I mean, we got the ethanol plants, everything else in outstate Minnesota. Let's start getting some of the research out there where the sources are. Instead of us, I mean, we saw what happened to Extinction a couple of years ago, and I'm still quite angry about that. It used to be the University of Minnesota was the engine that drove agriculture. And when they start coming back into my district and they start cutting down one livestock person, my entire district, and some of the proposals they came up with, I had a hard, I mean, U of M has lost their perspective as far as it being a land-grant institution. And I think we need to put our feet down here as an opportunity for outstate Minnesota to get a $30 million building. I don't care where.
Thank you, Mr. Fanker. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Emmingson, I want to just thank you for your presentation. You've been in my office on a couple of occasions, and we've talked about these issues. And so I want to just ask a couple questions. They're finance-related, but I think that they go to the long-term policy of where the state can go in this area. And so my first question is, we may build this infrastructure, but what are the yearly costs going to be, operational costs, for operating this center? If you look into the future after we build this facility, what is it going to be in the next 5 to 10 years per year to operate this facility?
Representative Welty, we are in the middle of the pre-design and scoping, and ultimately the design of this building, which will answer the question with respect to the building operations, and I can't answer that today. There's another aspect, though, the ongoing, you could say, operating costs or operating opportunities, and that is the capacity to fund the research that needs to be done to advance us to this next generation, because the facility itself doesn't do the research. You need not only the financial resources to do the research, but the human resources to do it. And we've got a good start in that regard with respect to the funding this legislature made available in 2003. About half of the portfolio, as you'll see in more detail next week when we give a more comprehensive overview of this initiative, is invested in projects with a very direct impact on agriculture in rural Minnesota. That research portfolio, limited by the amount of the appropriation made available, has averaged about little over $4 million a year, about half of that in this biofuels area. That, by the way, has leveraged some significant external resources from the Department of Energy and so forth. But to your specific question in terms of heat, lights, fuel, I don't have the answer to that today. That's what our design and scoping process will ascertain.
Thank you. Thank you for the follow-up. And I wasn't just talking about the heat lights. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the research, because I know we've talked about this before, and that kind of moves to my next question, and that is, you know, we take a look at IREE, and I think that was a wonderful program that they set up in 2003 with the $10 million investment from Excel and other sources. When we look at the research and how much it's going to cost for the research for IREE, and then we look at the cost for the research for this new center, do you see us in the future possibly narrowing our scope because we're going to focus so much on the biofuels that we don't focus so much on the goals of IREE? Or do you see this as an expansion? And then going back to that question, how much do you anticipate the cost being for the IREE portion of this and then also the biofuel research center?
Well, again, based on our current history with respect to resources we had available, it's roughly a $20 million program over 5 years. About 40% of that is specifically related to biofuels and bioproducts, the way the, you know, the research grants that were funded came out. I would anticipate that if we want to continue the kind of effort that we've had in this regard, we're going to need to continue to make an investment of about that magnitude. Those resources, by the way, will leverage significant outside external resources from the Department of Energy, USDA, the National Science Foundation, perhaps from the new commitment that the President referenced in the State of the Union address. But there will, in all fairness, need to be a significant state investment to leverage those external resources to ultimately have the kind of economic impact that we want to see in this arena, at least, which will largely be in agriculture in rural Minnesota to the extent we're doing it with biomass resources.
I believe this will be my final follow-up. I just want to thank you for your presentation. I want to thank you for bringing this proposal forward, Chairman Davids. I really believe it's time for Minnesota to take the lead. We've taken the lead in ethanol. We've taken the lead in biodiesel. And I think that we've only begun down the path of where we could possibly go with biofuel research and development. And I think that this sheds a lot of light on the possibilities and the potentials of where we could go in the short term and also in the long term. Definitely, as we look at the global perspective, this is where we need to go when we look at the United States and their position globally, look at the resources that we have and the finite resources in petroleum and just our fossil fuels. I think this is a great step for the state of Minnesota. I fully support you on this proposal, but I just wanted to outline the future costs that this will incur, and I want to make sure that as we move forward, we're planning for sustainable funding for this, for you, so that we have a successful program, so that 5 to 10 years down the road, we're not cutting what is a very beneficial program for our state and for rural development. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Welty. Representative Junkie, Tennis, and then Erdahl. Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I want to back up the I don't think we finished the Hygerkin discussion, and I think it's a good one because that's exactly what I was thinking, Representative Hygerkin. And we didn't give Mr. Hemingsley a chance to answer. Why in the world wouldn't we put this on the Morris campus with the where we already have renewable energy research going on, and wind anhydrous, all the other things going on out there? Why wouldn't we focus on that campus then for our biofuels? It seems like a perfect match made in heaven. Why are we talking about a Twin Cities campus location?
Mr. Hemingsley?
Representative Junkie, there are two kinds of resources you need for this work to ultimately have the kind of impact we need. The biological resources, which, as you know, aren't growing on the wall of the St. Paul campus. They are growing in Clements and Wilmer and, you know, Osakis and so forth. But the other thing you need is the human resources to do the kind of research, to have the kind of impacts we have. As I said, this initiative to date has captured the expertise of some 200 faculty across the University of Minnesota, from the Institute of Technology, Dr. Lanny Schmidt, for example, the College of Agriculture, Biological Sciences, Humphrey Institute, the Carlson School of Management, College of Architecture and Landscape Architecture, and faculty from the Research and Outreach Centers at Morris. The fact of the matter is the human resources, with the capacity to develop the fundamental research that's going to lead to the commercialization of these technologies is on the Twin Cities campus.
Mr. Chair, I guess following up with that, obviously if you're building a new building and staffing it, there'd be new staff brought in for that building, so I guess I'm not following. I understand the collaborative aspect you're talking about, but in this day and age of communications and email and ITV and all the other things, I guess I'm missing the reasoning why this building would have to be on the Twin Cities campus. Maybe you can try and help me out with that again. Because, again, if you're building and staffing a new facility, you're obviously recruiting people to office in that building, or we wouldn't need the building. If we're just using a collaborative system, then everyone's already got an office, everyone's already there. But you're talking about expansion and building of a program specifically. So I don't understand why we couldn't put the building and the program out at Morris and then, again, collaborate with other people on whatever campus they're on. They might even be from Duluth campus or Crookston or anywhere else. As you say, there's biology programs and other things at Morris now as well as other research. So I guess I'm really trying to understand why that building could not be located on the Morris campus.
Mr. Hammond?
Mr. Chair, Representative Junkie, the model for this with respect to the science that would be done is very similar to that done in the current Cargill building for microbial and plant genomics. And with respect to the kind of faculty that would be there, it would be a blend of existing faculty, as is the case in the Cargill building, faculty from now 6 colleges across the university working collaboratively, side by side in laboratories, to develop in a multidisciplinary way these initiatives. And so to the first part of your comment about all new people, it wouldn't all be new people. It would be new facilities, new pilot scale equipment that has been sought. In fact, I was in a meeting yesterday talking about a current Department of Energy solicitation for a major biorefinery in the state, one that we may not be able to participate in just because of the magnitude of the plant that they envision building in the private match. But the point of that discussion is private industry, both small and large, in this case a small startup company, looking at the kind of facilities in order to the pilot lab type facilities. In order to have those, you need the people the researchers, the graduate students there to do that, and again, they are on the Twin Cities campus for the most part. I would be happy to have you take us up, any of the members of this committee, on our invitation to come over to the campus someday to visit with some of the researchers working on these projects. And I think that would be a good opportunity for you to see firsthand what the rest of the answer to your question is, and we would welcome that opportunity.
And Mr. Chair, I'm just not convinced that we should let this go out of this committee with the Twin Cities campus being the sole and only verbiage on here. At least there ought to be a something else to look at, like I say, the Morris campus in particular, where we've already got this research. I'm not quite convinced yet, and I see Representative Heigerkin's got his hand up again, I'm sure, to this topic. So I agree with him. I think this committee needs to have that discussion and really get an understanding of why this building can't be somewhere else. Just like if you remember our fight on the Department of Agriculture building, which I'll remind them of every chance I get, was supposed to be in rural Minnesota, and it's just down the street here. And I think it would have functioned quite well out in Preston or Wilmer or Freeport. I don't think that would have been a problem whatsoever. So,
they were junkie. I've got 17 members with questions, and I've got 13 members. So what we're going to do is we're going to lay this bill over, because I believe we have Representative, and I do have the list in order here, so we will get back to it. But we do have a presentation we also need on tuberculosis that we have to do today. So if you could stick around, we'll try and get to you on the other end and continue to move. And but before I do withdraw it, I'm going to change my motion that the bill, House File 2781, be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Higher Ed Finance. They want to see it also, so that's where it would go, just for the record. We will come back to File 8, 2781 over. I will now call Representative Peterson, Representative Hamilton.
Mr. Chair, will that bill come back to this committee then?
No, it would go. No, we're going to have all the questions asked before it would get out of here. So, yeah, we'll come back to it. Representative Peterson, if you could please come before the committee and the folks who would like to testify on this bill. I will move House File 2645. You recommend pass and sent to the House floor. I will now move to get the bill in the shape the author would like. I will move the H2645A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill in the order the author would like. And there's some more folks who joined us here. Is there anyone that wishes to testify against House File 2645 as amended? Okay, then, Representative Peterson, if you could please describe your bill for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. Describing this, it's for Swift County, which is county seat Benson, county west of Wilmer, between Wilmer and the South Dakota border. We're looking to expand the board of directors, the Rural Development Finance Authority, from 7 to 9 directors, and then 2 to 4 must be representative of county-based EDAs, and then no more than 3. From 2 to 3 directors may reside in one commissioner district in Swift County. With me today to describe more of the reason why we're here is Super Sig with Swift County Grow Economic Development and Belinda Sanders from Swift County as well. So if they could take a little time from the committee, I'd appreciate it, and then we can stand for questions, and thank you for your motion.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. Who'd like to go first?
I will.
Okay, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Belinda Sanders. I'm the branch manager of the Co-op Credit Union in Benson. I'm the secretary of the Rural Development Board. What we would like to do is we would like to expand our board to a 9-member board from a 7-member, and we would like to be able to have currently has 2 people per district to serve on the board, and we would like to move that to have a 3-person board, or 3 person from each district to be allowed to serve on the board.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Sanders. Any questions for Ms. Sanders? Okay. Ms. Persig, if you please identify yourself for the record.
Hi, my name is Susan Persig. I'm the executive director of the Swift County Rural Development Finance Authority. Formerly, we were a private nonprofit corporation called GROW, and that's the way Representative Peterson introduced me, as the executive director of Swift County GROW. I am the staff person for this organization. You created us with law a few years back, and we would like to just update that to allow us a little bit more representation from across the county. With our 7-member board, it limits fewer people can participate, and we'd like to increase the participation.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Persig? Okay, with that, if there are no other questions of the author or the two folks that testified, I will renew my motion that House File 2645, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the House floor. Any other discussion? To the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Tim Peterson and Ms. Persig and Sanders.
Thank you for your time and attention and motion.
Okay. We'll go now to Dr. Hartman. And members, on your agenda, it is the item 6, a report from the Minnesota Board of Animal Health regarding bovine tuberculosis. This is a very serious issue that this committee has been staying on top of and will continue to. I'd also like to introduce to the members a new House research analyst, Colby Sullivan. Welcome to the committee. And also, we are very fortunate to have DFL researcher Mr. Musilevich and Republican researcher Mr. Werner. So we're ready to go for 06 here. Okay, welcome to the committee, Dr. Bill Hartman. And I will let you introduce folks and make your presentation. And I do believe, just so members know, I believe Representative Pennis is working on a bill that may, you're not?
I don't know.
We don't know if Representative Pennis is working on a bill. So with that being said, let's go into the presentation. And there are some things that Dr. Hartman, I believe, will need legislatively, and we'll want to take a look at those at the appropriate time. But if you could please present your or give us your presentation, Dr. Hartman.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Hartman. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health and the State Veterinarian. And with me, I've got a little bit of a change from your agenda. Mike Stein is not here from USDA, but I have Dr. Heidi Kassenberg from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Also, we have Mike Don Carlos from the Minnesota DNR. And then we thought we'd shake in some people from the real world. And so we invited Don Schiefelbein. And Don, if you want to come down and we'll grab a chair. Don is with the Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association and is in the cattle business. So I thought it important that we see his perspective as well. And I'll just start with my part of it. I want to just cover what's happened so far and where we're headed. This has truly been a cooperative effort, this investigation that we've done with bovine tuberculosis. I mentioned Dr. Kassenberg with the Department of Agriculture. The Department of Agriculture has provided us with resources so that we can deal with this situation. We've worked very closely with the DNR as well, and the reason for that is there's a wildlife component to this. We've found some bovine tuberculosis in the deer and elk. And then Mike Stein isn't here, but he is the acting veterinarian in charge, or the area veterinarian in charge for USDA in Minnesota. And USDA has been a strong partner. This is a national eradication program. It's not just Minnesota that's involved. And so far, USDA has spent over $3 million helping us fight this battle. So I wish he could have been here, but he couldn't make it. I'll try and talk to you about his part of it. I'll just start out a little bit telling you about the disease, bovine tuberculosis. It is caused by a bacteria, and the name of that bacteria is Mycobacterium bovis. It's primarily a disease of cattle, that's why it's called bovine tuberculosis, but it really can affect any warm-blooded animals. So it's potential there to affect other animals besides cattle, and it can impact people too, and we'll talk just a little bit about that too. It has been a problem over time in cattle, but we've essentially eliminated the disease from cattle. In the last 10 years, there's been some resurgence of it in captive deer and elk herds in the United States. Luckily, we haven't had any of that in Minnesota. And currently, there's a problem with it, probably one of the more difficult problems with it in Michigan, where not only has it affected 36 cattle herds, but it is endemic in the free-ranging white-tailed deer in a specific part of Michigan. There is a related bacteria, Mycobacterium tuberculosis, that causes TB in people, and that's the common tuberculosis in people. It's a respiratory disease, as is the disease in cattle. That disease has been brought down to a very low level in the United States as well, but occasionally comes back when people from other countries move here. There is quite a bit of human tuberculosis in the world, so that's a concern. I'm just going to tell you when this started. It was last February that I first got notification that an animal that was slaughtered in Green Bay, Wisconsin was found, and every animal that we slaughter, surveillance is done for TB. So this animal had lesions, and when I say lesions, I mean changes in the body that looked like it was tuberculosis. So they notified me that they had a suspicious case. Tissues from that cow were sent down to our National Veterinary Services Lab in Ames, Iowa. How we do our surveillance for TB is when these animals are marketed, a piece of paper, a back tag it's called, is glued onto the animal, and when they're slaughtered then, if they see lesions of TB, they remove that back tag and they send along. They let us know what that back tag number was on that animal, and we then know which sale barn those are distributed to. We contacted the sale barn, and that sale barn was up in northwestern Minnesota. And then looking through their records, we found the herd of origin for that animal that got slaughtered. And this slide just shows where that herd was located, near Skyme, Minnesota. It's pretty close to the Canadian border. I can attest to that it's a long drive up there. I've been up there several times. It takes you about 6 or 7 hours, depending on where you're going up there. So that's the herd that we discovered. When we found this herd, the first thing we wanted to do is make sure that we'd gotten back to the right herd. This is a big herd. This owner has a big investment in the herd, and so we decided that we would do a herd test. I show this slide to show you that there still are cowboys in Minnesota and ranches. It's not just Texas. This is the herd that we're talking about. And he had a purebred component to his herd and a commercial part to his herd. His purebred herd was Tarentaise, and that's the Tarentaise bull on the right, and then Black Angus bulls on the right, on the left. So he had both Black Angus and Tarentaise, and some of his commercial herd was crossbred. Very good herd. So we set up to do a herd test on that herd, and this is the setup we had. We used RFID tags in the cattle so we could identify them and read them with readers electronically and put that information into the computer as we tested them. When we tested them, the way that we test cattle for TB is how you get tested for TB. It's a manto test. It's an intradermal skin injection. And in cattle, the best spot that we've found to do that testing is at the tail head, in that area you can see that doesn't have hair on it. So we do an injection there, and then we come back in 3 days and feel that skin. And if it's thickened or if it has a big lump in it, that's a responder. And if we found responders, then we'd come in afterward and do a comparative cervical test on those animals. So we cut the hair on two different parts of the neck, and we inject tuberculin that's from birds on the top and from cattle on the bottom. That's how we remember it. And then we measure the differences between, we come back, well, we use that caliper to measure the skin thickness before we inject. We come back 3 days later, and then we use that caliper again to get a good accurate reading on how the increase in skin thickness, and then we plot it on this graph, and it's either a negative, a suspect, or a reactor. We did one additional test on those cattle. We did a gamma interferon test. That's a little bit more research mode, but we wanted to learn from this. So those blood samples were sent to Michigan to be tested on a gamma interferon test. After we tested his herd, and he had 586 animals, we found 21 of those animals that were reactors, we called. And so those were appraised, and the owner agreed to a price on them. We hauled those down to our veterinary diagnostic lab here in the Twin Cities, and they were a necropsy was done on them. That's the necropsy floor out at our diagnostic lab. And we were looking for lesions in these animals, and we found, five animals that had what looked like tuberculosis. Four of those were histocompatible, so that means when we looked at them under the microscope, it looked like the type of inflammatory reaction we see with TB. One of them was positive on a DNA test, a PCR test for tuberculosis, which was done at our National Veterinary Services Lab. And this is what those lesions look like. None of these cattle that we've found with tuberculosis have had any clinical signs of the disease. They've all been perfectly healthy-looking animals, no symptoms at all. And we've only in one cow actually found any changes in the lungs. The primary changes have been in the lymph nodes of the body. And these are just lymph nodes. They're much larger than they should be. And those white areas, that's the inflammatory reaction to this bacteria that you see. A good thing we did this after lunch, right? This is the alkaline digester that we have out at our veterinary diagnostic lab. It's a great big vat. It's filled with an alkaline solution. It's put under pressure and heated, and if you put livestock in there after their necropsied, it makes them disappear. So that's how we disposed of them. It's important that we dispose of them in some manner like that because this is a bacteria that potentially can cause disease in people. We wish we had an area out at that veterinary diagnostic lab that actually had biosafety containment level, but we didn't. So people had to wear masks and face masks and gloves while they were doing these necropsies. Now, once we got, so that herd, then based on that, the information we had after we tested the herd, we did these necropsies, we went and talked to the owner and we agreed that his herd was infected with TB. He made the decision voluntarily on his own to depopulate the herd. It was not an easy decision. He'd been in this business for 35 years. He'd developed a very good herd. And it was not only a financial burden for him, but a very emotional thing, too. But for the sake of the cattle industry and us getting our free status back, he agreed to depopulate his herd. That has been done. He's been paid his indemnity, and he's cleaned and disinfected and been removed from quarantine. We then moved on to the disease investigation. And when we do that, we do two things. We look at the herds that have fence line contact with him. And he had four herds that were right near him, where the cattle were right together at the fence line, so they had contact. We tested those four herds. Two of them tested negative, and we released from quarantine. Two of them we found TB in. So we had then our second and third infected herds with his neighbors. After we did that, this diagram shows that we looked at all of the cattle that he'd purchased over the last 7 years, and all of the cattle that he had sold from his herd over the last 7 years. And that got to be quite a few herds. Let's see, we had 14 herds in Minnesota in 7 different counties. So those herds all had to be quarantined. And then once we quarantine those herds, if they had purchased animals from him, we have to actually find those animals, appraise them, and then get them to slaughter and test them to make sure, to find out whether they have TB. If they do, then we have another infected herd. If they don't, then we can release quarantine on those herds. In addition to that, there were 11 herds that went to 7 other states in that investigation. None of the traces to other states, did they find any TB? They were all negative. The investigation in Minnesota, there was one herd that we looked at. There were some animals that tested positive. This was in northern Roseau County. He had purchased some animals from this infected herd, and that herd turned out to be infected, so we had our fourth infected herd. And that herd has, again, been, all four of those herds have been appraised, indemnified, and depopulated. Three of those are still waiting to clean and disinfect because it's cold up in northern Minnesota and everything's frozen and it's hard to do that. We then moved on to the disease investigation on the three additional herds, so we had to do the traces in and out of those herds and the fence line contacts. And in that, we found one additional herd, which is, let's see, I think I might have a... This is a picture that shows that original herd, his land holdings. He has about 5,000 acres, and the red areas are where his cattle are pastured. The green and the blue area are his neighbors with the fence line contact that we talked about that were infected. And I'll get to this in just a minute. So when we did the traces out of those three herds, we found one more infected herd, and he had purchased 15 heifers that went through a sale barn and then were purchased by the fifth infected herd, so that's the connection there, and that herd is in northwestern Beltrami County. So as of today, we've found five beef cattle herds, so there's not been any in dairy cattle, it's all been in beef cattle herds that are infected. USDA has spent about $3.2 million indemnifying those cattle and for the depopulation. All of those herds are linked either by fence line contact or that they purchased cattle directly out of another infected herd. We found a very low prevalence in all those herds. Under 1% of the animals actually had TB. So they're not heavily infected herds. They're fairly lightly infected herds. That's good news. Means the disease probably hasn't been around too long. In the whole investigation, what this slide shows is we've quarantined 98 herds statewide. So there's a lot of work that's being done. The blue circles are herds that have been quarantined, but the quarantines have been released. So you can see there's been some confusion about that. People down in Rochester are worried. Well, you can see the herds that were down in that area have all been tested and found negative. So the purple triangles are herds we're still working on. So there are still a few herds up in that area. Actually, there are 23 herds that are still under quarantine we're still working on. And then the red flags show you where the infected herds were. The three that are in that middle flag, the one up in northern Roseau County, and then the one in northwestern Beltrami County. In addition to this part of the investigation, we're also offering free testing to any cattle owner who has cattle within a 15-mile radius of any of the infected herds. And so far, we've had 25 herds volunteer to test in that zone. Minnesota has lost its tuberculosis-free status because of this. That happened in December, I think. And this map just shows what other states have lost their status. Texas actually has never been a tuberculosis-free state. They've had a continual problem with it in their dairy cattle as well as their beef cattle. New Mexico has one large dairy herd that's infected, and that's why just a part of their state is modified accredited events. So they've gotten split state status. And then I mentioned Michigan. The Upper Peninsula is free. The majority of Michigan is modified, accredited, advanced, and then that one area that they have a problem in, the free-ranging white-tailed deer, is modified, accredited. So that's an even lower status. Because of us losing our status, so there have been some changes to the interstate movement requirements. So cattle leaving Minnesota now have to be tested before they can go to other states in most cases, and it's cattle that are 6 months of age and over. In addition to that, some of the surrounding states have taken more strict requirements than that for importing. So what we're telling producers is before you send cattle out of state, make sure you contact the state of destination to make sure you know what those requirements are. I've met with USDA to discuss what it'll take for Minnesota to get its free status back. I've done that with DNR, and we had a meeting last Friday, and I think we're in general agreement with USDA what we need to do at this point to get our free status back. It'll take, we have a 2-year waiting period that we have to go through, and during that time we need to finish our disease investigation, and then we need to test cattle, and I'll put up another slide here. Within a 10-mile radius of any infected herd, and then or any free-ranging whitetail deer that shot where it shot. And so this is a map that just shows the red dots are the infected herds, the red zones are the areas we must test cattle and captive deer and elk herds to get our free status back. And let's see, there's some other things on the slide too. I don't know how important they are. The green squares are where there are captive cervid herds in that area that we know we have to test. The brown squares are cattle herds that we know we're going to have to test. And the yellow triangles are dairy herds. So we're still in that process, though, of identifying all the herds in that zone that need to be tested. This loss of TB-free status, it comes at a great loss to the cattle industry. It's going to be very, and Don will tell you about that, it's going to be very expensive until we get our free status back for cattlemen to move animals interstate. There's been some loss of markets, I think, because of it. So at the Board of Animal Health, we understand how important it is to get this status back as soon as possible, and we've dedicated all our resources to make sure that we get that process going. And we've gotten excellent cooperation not only from the other state agencies, but also the cattle industry. The Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association has been right there with us, making sure we're moving ahead. And the cattlemen up in that area, too, in Representative Pennis's area, it's been a tough time for them, but I think in general they've been very supportive of what we're doing and understand the importance of doing it. And, Mr. Chairman, with that, I would turn it back to you.
Thank you, Dr. Hartman. Did anybody else wish to testify now? Are they going to help some questions? I think you said the gentleman from the Cattlemen's Association might have a few remarks, and then we can go to questions.
It's up to you, Mr. Chairman. DNR and MDA have presentations, too, if you have time. But
okay, well, let's just go right down. Is it Mr. Don Carlos? If you please give us your presentation, and we'll go to, is it Kassenberg?
Correct.
Kassenberg, okay. And then to the Cattlemen's Association.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mike Don Carlos. I'm here representing the Department of Natural Resources. Thanks for the opportunity to talk to you.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
I think I'll start where Dr. Hartman left off and echo the concern for the livestock industry and DNR's understanding of how important this is. And the department is committed because, as you've heard, and I'll talk a little more about, there is a wildlife component to this that's going to be that needs to be addressed by USDA in order to regain our TB-free status. And we're committed to make sure that we do our part to accomplish that, and I'll talk about that a little bit. In 2005, when we first became aware of TB in cattle, we decided to immediately set up to do hunter harvest surveillance in the fall with a pretty high statistical threshold. We wanted to sample enough deer to have a pretty high degree of confidence that we would detect TB in deer if it was out there. And then secondly, we wanted to gather information that would allow us to possibly determine a rate of infection if we found it. And, of course, look at the spatial distribution and the disease in deer to try to get a better understanding of what was going on and to lead us in changes, if any, in deer management that might be required. In the fall of 2005, we identified two surveillance zones, and these surrounded four of the now five infected farms. The fifth farm we became aware of literally on the eve of the surveillance, and so we weren't able to fully gear up to a sample in that area. However, you'll see in a minute on the slide that we were able to expand our sample collection a bit out into that area. So we had two 15-mile radius surveillance areas, 15 miles was selected to try to make sure that we were looking far enough out that we would encounter most all of the deer that might have been associated with those farms. And we looked at a large enough population of deer to get a sense of, if we found TB, what its distribution might be in the population. We did a contract with the College of Veterinary Medicine using students. The tissues we selected were lymph nodes, mandibular nodes, and retropharyngeal nodes. We set up registration stations. As many of you may know, deer registration by deer hunters is mandatory in Minnesota, and hunters need to take their deer to identified stations and register them. And, of course, this facilitates access to virtually all of the deer that are killed by us. So we staffed up these registration stations to collect the samples. Samples went to the same lab that Dr. Hartman uses, the university's veterinary diagnostic lab, and then for initial screening, and then on to the NVSL lab down in Ames, Iowa, for further culturing. And we did the surveillance on the opening weekend of the firearms deer season, which is when the preponderance of deer are killed up there. This is a slide of the area up there showing you the 15-mile radius from Skye, Minnesota, and then Salal, roughly the center areas for the three infected farms down by Skye, and then the one up in the Salal area. And here are the results of that surveillance. We had a total of 474 deer sampled. They're represented by the green dots. I should point out those are locations. Some of those green dots have multiple samples, so if someone were to count them up, there are not 474 dots there. There's some duplications. As I'm sure you all know by now, we found one positive animal in that sample of 474, and it's marked on the map. That was a 5.5-year-old buck that was taken about 1 mile from the Skye Farm location. And that was the only one that we found. And the strain type we now know is the same as the strain type that's in cattle. And that type is consistent with all of the animals that we've tested so far. Looking ahead in 2006, we wanted to, in addition to continuing surveillance of our deer population in the area, we wanted to take a closer look at the farm level. And so we worked with the affected livestock operations and offered shooting permits to all of them to make sure that we were meeting the needs and the desires of those producers to get additional deer sampling on their farm and in close proximity to it. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. Additionally, in 2006, we're going to continue to work closely with the Board of Animal Health in making sure that DNR is keeping up with this and doing our part. We're particularly pleased to see that it looks like the number of quarantine herds is going down. We're not likely to be in southeastern Minnesota, it looks like, this fall. We might be a little bit outside of this area, but what we're committed to doing is the same 15-mile radius and high level of sampling for any infected TB farms that we have by this fall's deer season. So we'll have three surveillance areas at this point. We may have more should we have the misfortune of finding more disease in cattle. And then finally, we need to begin, and we have. Dr. Hartman and I met with USDA last Friday to start discussions about wildlife surveillance, and again, to make sure that DNR is going to meet USDA's needs. So when the Board of Animal Health gets through the two-year process of finding and eliminating TB, that we're ready to that we're not holding up the process. Okay. So far to date, two of the landowners have been working on shooting permits. We've killed 60 additional deer, predominantly in that Skye area. And these are deer that are either on or immediately adjacent to these infected farms, so it's a little bit different focus than the larger deer population. We do have one presumptive positive. We're awaiting confirmation down at Ames, Iowa. But at this point, we're expecting to find one additional positive deer. We will continue with shooting permits through the end of this month, and we'll be working with the landowners further than that. For example, there are at least two locations up there where there are due to herd management, i.e. no cattle and no feed on the farm this winter. There are no deer on or even really in the vicinity of these farms. We expect that to change when green-up occurs late March, early April, and at that point we'll look at shooting permits again. You know, so if deer start moving back into these areas that have had bovine TB and livestock, we're going to be ready to go to take additional deer. We have consulted with Michigan, both the Department of Ag and DNR. In fact, we invited them to come into Minnesota and meet with us and the Board of Animal Health. And we've gone through their program and their experience, and their situation is different than ours, but nevertheless, they would be the experts in the TB interface between cattle and livestock. And then we met with USDA, and I think generally the meeting was positive, and I think we're on track. There's a couple of more things that we'll be working on in DNR to tune up our surveillance planning, but I think that we're going to be able to pretty easily meet USDA's needs. One of the things that we'll be looking at is probably for 2007 is some level of statewide deer surveillance. We don't have any reason to believe that it's going to be elsewhere in the state, but you know, it'd be nice to cover that base from USDA's perspective, and so we'll be doing that. And and we may take a look at deer feeding as well. In the fall of 2006, in addition to the ongoing work with the affected livestock producers now, in the fall of 2006, we'll be gearing up for this surveillance strategy. And again, it's assuming we don't find any more infected herds. And we'll go back out and look at the same level that we did this year to see if there's been any change, and essentially to verify what's out there for deer. And we'll probably be continuing that level of surveillance in these areas, I would say indefinitely, until we get through and through this process and then back to our TB-free status. And I'd be happy to take any questions at that point, or Mr. Chairman, if you'd like to move on to other presenters.
Thank you, Mr. Don Carlos. One quick question on the map there. The radius goes up into Canada. How are you coordinating with Canadian officials at all?
We will be meeting with Manitoba officials. We talked to them on the phone. They're interested in this. And I understand that they have or will be doing some surveillance in that area. But that's just an artifact of the border, and I'm glad you brought that up. We're not sampling in Manitoba. It just falls within that surveillance area. They will be, and, of course, they'll share that information with us when they get it.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Don Carlos or Flint Pennis?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably Dr. Hartman or any of you. But I think it's important that it be noted that the DNA sequence on this is not like Canada. Canada does have some TB. If you could just address that briefly for the
meeting. Dr. Hartman.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pennis, I left that out of my talk. Thank you. That's very important. All five of these herds we've isolated bacteria from, as well as the one deer that was shot during the hunter harvest. And that bacteria, they did DNA typing of it, and it resembles the bacteria that we find in Mexico and southwestern United States. It's different than what we find in Michigan and what they've found in Canada. So if we had to theorize where did this TB, we haven't found a source for this TB infection in northwestern Minnesota, but if we had to theorize, we would say that it probably came in with cattle from somewhere in the southwestern part of the United States.
Okay, thank you. Okay, let's go to Dr. Kastenbarg. Just kind of a time schedule here for members. We've got the room until 4:15. I'd like to go to about 4:10 with the next two testifiers, and then I've got an amendment for House File 2781. We're done with Peter. Yeah, done, Peter. And then see if it's okay to move it on to the next committee with the caveat that we will have more discussion on the issue of location in this committee, even though it would not be in this committee. And I'll give you my commitment that I do want input from this committee before it's heard the next. But just since we have 20 days till first deadline, we need to get things moving. So, okay, Dr. Kastenbarg.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dr. Heidi Kastenbarg, and I'm representing the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I've actually got three subtopics of this. I'm going to talk about what this means for our food supply. The second is our efforts to an organizational structure to launch this investigation, and then third, some of the technologies for the future that would make this process a lot easier. So why do we care about tuberculosis? Dr. Hartman briefly talked about that this is an animal disease, but why do we care? Why was there a program put in place to eliminate this disease? Well, tuberculosis in history was pretty devastating. It was a leading cause of death in the 18th and 19th centuries. And actually, one out of every nine people died was due to TB. Now, the majority of these were the human type of tuberculosis. There's a couple of different types of tuberculosis. But this is a pretty low estimate. CDC ranges anywhere between 10 and 30% of people actually had the bovine form or the cow form of tuberculosis when they came down with tuberculosis. So, you know, the turn of the last century, there were a lot of people with tuberculosis, and of those, there was a significant proportion of those that had the form that's primarily found in cattle. And this just shows a little closer to home the cases of human tuberculosis in Minnesota from 1918, when records started to be kept, up until the turn of this century. So you can see it has decreased quite a bit. And again, most of these were the human form, but there's a significant portion that were the bovine form. So how did people get TB from animals? The primary route was drinking unpasteurized milk. And why we pasteurize milk is because one of the main reasons is because of tuberculosis. People would get that, primarily children, and it would lead to a lot of bone deformities. Rarely people can get this disease from meat, but mostly it was meat cutters that would get skin infections. This bacteria is not found in the muscle tissue, so it's pretty rare to find a person that got it from eating meat from an infected animal. This shows a picture of children at tuberculosis sanatoriums. Agua Ching, the state facility that originated as a TB sanatorium. It's a different purpose today, but that's what its main purpose was when it was first built. And this is, I remember being tested for TB going into school. And as Dr. Harlan mentioned, people got the mantle test for that. And it's a similar thing that we do for cattle. So it caused big problems with humans, but it also caused a lot of problems with cattle. Fortunately, the infection in the cattle in Minnesota today hasn't caused a lot of economic loss, but back when this infection was widespread, it would cause a lot of decreased production, not only in milk, but also two-thirds of condemned beef carcasses back, you know, when the jungle was published, back when meat inspection first got its start. Two-thirds of all the condemned beef carcasses were because of tuberculosis. A lot of cattle carcasses, 2.5% of cattle carcasses were retained. Very few cattle carcasses are retained or removed from sale because of any reason, let alone TB today. And then just to show that this is not a disease of poor husbandry practices, 35 of 40 cows that Queen Victoria had tested positive for tuberculosis. So it's not a, certainly these animals I'm sure were cared for quite well, but it did show the wide extent of this particular disease. So how we safeguard against this disease today, and how we can be assured that Minnesota's meat supply is safe. We pasteurize milk, and you know, the situation now is beef cattle, and of course we don't milk beef cattle. But one of the main reasons we pasteurize is because of tuberculosis. And then we also inspect animals before and after slaughter. And one of the main reasons for that is because of tuberculosis. And then back in the early part of the 20th century, we launched the bovine tuberculosis eradication campaign to remove this disease from the cattle population. And that has led to restrictions on cattle movement if TB is found in a particular state, which has led to our loss of TB free status today because they don't want it to be transmitted throughout the United States. So then I mentioned about tuberculosis in milk. localized in the bone. And then just a picture of people doing, a person doing slaughter. And so what about the animals from herds that have TB? They were very, animals that had a positive TB test were euthanized and destroyed, and the rest of the herds were looked at very, very closely. If there's a, if the herd is suspected of tuberculosis, in addition to the common everyday procedures that slaughter plants go through, there are special procedures to look even harder for evidence of tuberculosis within those carcasses. And anything that was suspicious was removed and the carcasses were destroyed. There is a clause in the Federal Meat Inspection Act where portions of the carcass can be trimmed and used for sale, but most of the meat slaughter facilities don't really want to mess with that. They just go ahead and destroy it. So that brings us to the second part of this. Certainly the tracing that Dr. Hartman talked about, the finding of all these animals, the scheduling the testing, and getting this information out to farmers, producers, and the media takes a considerable amount of resources. And so, things like developing these maps, the data for this to be generated to find all these producers within these zones takes a lot of resources and a lot of coordination between different agencies. And so this has really been a team effort between the Board of Animal Health, the Department of Agriculture, and we made a significant linkage with our Farm Service Agency because they have a lot of data to locational information to identify the producers within the affected area, as well as DNR. And USDA has not only provided monetary resources, but they've also provided staffing resources as well. And then our partners with University of Minnesota Extension has allowed us to get information out to producers and people in the affected areas. So to coordinate all these resources, how do you do that in a meaningful manner? What has been proposed, and this isn't something that's, and I'll get to this in a later slide, this isn't something that the Minnesota Department of Agriculture or USDA has dreamed up. This system is called the Incident Command System, and it's something that emergency management agencies have been using for quite a while. It started out in the wildland fires in the 70s. There's so many resources that came into those in California, but there was so many different jurisdictions and different terminology for fire engine that it was a complete mess. And so out of that, the fire service got together with some of their military colleagues to figure out a system that would make sense for any emergency, because within any emergency there are some core things that I'll get to in a couple of slides that will make it much easier to handle an emergency. So without this incident command system, people are running around, you're not really very coordinated. But with the incident command system, you take all those people that, are well-intentioned and put them into a structure so that you're all moving forward. So what is this incident command structure that they talk about? Well, an acronym for it is called CFLOP. It means it's command, logistics, operations, planning, and finance. And what does that mean? Well, command is, or incident manager, it's really a person that takes all the information from the outbreak and talks with the person, with the policy folks, to figure out what needs to be done. PIO is a public information officer, which, as the name would suggest, getting information out to the public. And then also a liaison officer who coordinates with other state agencies or federal agencies. And, of course, the safety officer. So what does operations do? Within each emergency, there's somebody that you need to get things done. And so that's what operations does. Planning, you have to figure out, well, what do you need to get done? Where is this outbreak going? Where is this investigation going? How many resources do we need? Where are we going to get those resources? Logistics, finding the people and tools that are needed, and then finance administration paying for the bills. So these are really all the sort of basic structures that are needed for pretty much every emergency. And within those different areas, they can expand or contract as needed. The main principle behind this is that if situations or emergencies are local, and if they expand to the point where the individual or municipality or state exceeds their capacity, then they look to the next level for resources. And that's what the Board of Animal Health did, was they were exceeding their capacity to handle this situation. So they looked to other state agencies, like the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, the Department of Natural Resources, but also USDA to provide some of those resources. And I mentioned that this isn't something that we made up or decided to do on our own. Homeland Security has, or actually the President signed some presidential directives to establish a single comprehensive national incident management system, and they have, all federal agencies are required to handle emergencies with this incident management or incident command system. Similarly, our governor has signed that this is how state agencies will respond, and we've been training to do this both at Department of Agriculture, Board of Animal Health, and as well as other agencies. So what USDA has provided is basically this incident command system in a box. And so they provided incident commanders, planning, operation, logistics, and finance chiefs to help run this operation. And so what we did was have co-incident commanders, co-planning, co-operations, co-logistics, and just one finance chief. But then they integrated into the state system, so that we were able to satisfy the needs of the state, but then also because we need to satisfy the federal requirements, we need to make sure that what we were doing within the state met the Code of Federal Regulations so that we can achieve TB-free status at the end of this two-year period of time.
Dr. Kassenberg, how many more slides do you have?
Probably four.
Okay.
This just shows the structure here. Just to show you that this is a lot of people that are involved here. I can do this in a minute.
Thank you.
Okay. So this shows there's a lot of people here that are involved. And these are actual humans that have come from various parts of the country. We meet every day at 10 a.m. to discuss various things that have gone on with the particular investigation. And these are veterinarians from all over the country that have come. They provide six teams of people that rotate through. So that pretty much summarizes that this is a large effort, not only in the state, but also the federal level. Now, when Dr. Hartman talked about the TB-infected herds, the tracing that's involved in this, all these animals that come into these infected herds need to be traced. And then those herds need to be tested, and then these herds are depopulated. Those animals that go out need to be traced as well. Now, this is a big deal when you look at all these animals that are leaving the state. When you look at the old technology, these little metal tags that you have to read in these animals, it's a very difficult, time-consuming, laborious process. And so this puts in for the future, and what we're going to actually be using for some of our herds is radio frequency identification or electronic identification, also known as the National Animal Identification System. So this will greatly, so you can actually just use a wand to read those tags, because if anyone's been in front of a cow looking at these tiny little metal tags in their ears, it's very difficult to read.
Thank you, Dr. Representative Tremma.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I've read about 95% of the humans who contact bovine TB are cured. Is that correct?
Doctor?
I don't know that there's majority of TB cases now can be cured. So whether or not they are of human or bovine origin.
Mr. Chair, so is that possible with animals to cure them, or is slaughtering the only result?
Dr. Kassenberg, or Dr. Hartman, or
Mr. Chairman and Representative Otremba, two concerns with treating cattle. One is it would be very expensive. It would probably take way more than the value of the animal to treat. And the other is we're trying to eradicate the disease, so we don't want to leave any infection out there, and there'd be no way to treat it to be sure all the organism was gone. So we really don't treat animals.
Mr. Chair, my other question is you said that there was a slight possibility that the meat could be infected. Does cooking up to 160 degrees or something like that take care of it, or is it just because it's some kind of a sort of bacteria, is that possible as a preventative piece?
Mr. Chairman, yes, heat does, just like with pasteurization is heat treatment of milk to kill the bacteria. Heat treatment by cooking of meat also kills the bacteria, the tuberculosis bacteria.
And my final question, are they working on immunizations for any of this?
Dr.
There are, Mr. Chairman, there are vaccines for tuberculosis, but for cattle, that would interfere with the testing.
Thank you.
Senator Trimmer. Okay, with that, we will move on to Mr. Schuffelbein. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir. And I apologize for the time thing, because this is a very important presentation. It's a very serious issue. But I do have a bill up after this. And it's my bill. Now, if it was Representative Heigerken's bill, we could just keep talking. But with it, we'll just go from there. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Don Schiefelbein, and I represent the Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association. We have a farm around Kimball, Minnesota, that spans Wright, Meeker, and Stearns counties.
And what town do you live in?
We live in Meeker County. And basically, what we're trying to do is give you a perspective from the cattleman's viewpoint of where everything is. And what I for sure want to make sure is emphasized to this committee is this disease is absolutely devastating. Absolutely devastating. When I say that, you're saying, well, we just heard all the information from the scientists, and they act like it can be controlled rather easily. But when I say devastating, I mean you're affecting somebody's livelihood. And as a Minnesota State Cattlemen's representative, when one of our members' livelihood is at stake, we get pretty aggressive. There's a rule of thumb my dad always told me, is when you mess with somebody's children or you mess with their livelihood, you better be ready. In this case, you're asking somebody to depopulate. In layman's terms, what you're asking them to do is almost get out of the business, a business that they've spent lots of times, generations and generations developing. So as you contemplate this issue, I want to make sure you understand the scope of it. There may just be 5 infected herds, but it's just like any statistic. It doesn't matter to us in your backyard. Then that statistic becomes very, very important. I thought I'd just, Mr. Chairman, give you guys just a quick feedback of what our relations have been and what we see coming out of this TB situation. First and foremost, I must say, between the Board of Animal Health and the Department of DNR, they have been absolutely wonderful to work with. Absolutely wonderful. And I think you'd want to know that feedback from that standpoint. What we absolutely need, though, and this is where funding will be an issue, is we need absolutely complete containment of the disease. Again, because it's devastating and because you're asking for somebody to completely get out of the business if you happen to be infected, we have as our policy 100% containment. From beef cattle standpoint, Dr. Hartman is doing a wonderful job of closing what we call the web, all the relationships where the TB may have crossed, and putting their arms around it and trying to get a hold of the situation. I think we're on track, and I hate to put figures in front, but hopefully within the next month or two, we will have what we would call complete containment within the beef cattle area. However, on the deer site, this is the part that becomes very, very sensitive to a bunch of our members. And I understand the statistics of DNR, and I support their statistics until you put yourself in their shoes. And what I'm asking you to do is put yourself in the shoes of somebody who's a neighbor to one of the 5 infected herds. Okay? What we know is that neighbor had to become depopulated. Right? Now what we've discovered is that deer carry the same disease that caused your neighbors to become depopulated. How concerned are deer infections?